kill you before you made 100 miles.
I lived through the blast in Manhattan, so did Artie. How come the radiation hasn't already killed us?
Some people seem to be more resistant than others. It's a fluke. But that doesn't mean you can keep absorbing radiation and shrug it off.
Doctor, if I was going to die from radiation, I'd be bones by now. And the air's heavy of the shit anyway. You know it as well as I do. The stuff's everywhere.
The winds carried it, yes, he admitted. But you're wanting to walk right back into a super-contaminated area. Now, I don't know your reasons for wanting to go to...
No, you don't, she said. And you can't. So save your breath. I'm going to rest here for a while, and then I'm leaving.
Dr. Eichelbaum started to protest again. Then he saw the determination in the woman's stare, and he knew there was nothing more to be said. Still, it was in his nature to have the last word. You're crazy. Then he turned and stalked away, figuring he had better things to do than trying to keep another fruitcake from committing suicide.
Kansas, Artie Wisco said softly. That's a long way from here. Yeah, I'm going to need a good pair of shoes. Suddenly, Artie's eyes glistened with tears. He reached out and grasped Sister's hand, pressing it against his cheek. God bless you, he said. Oh, God bless you. Sister leaned down and hugged him, and he kissed her cheek. She felt the wetness of a tear, and her own heart ached for him. You're the finest lady I've ever known, he told her. Next to my wife, I mean. She kissed him, and then she straightened up again. Her eyes were wet, and she knew that in the years ahead she would think of him many times, and in her heart she would say a prayer for him. You go to Detroit, she said. You find her. You hear?
Yeah, I hear.
He nodded, his eyes as bright as new pennies. Sister turned away, and Paul Thorson followed her. Behind her, she heard Robot say,
Man, I had an uncle in Detroit. I was kind of thinking about...
Sister wound her way through the hospital and out the doors. She stood staring at the football field, which was covered with tents, cars, and trucks. The sky was dull gray, heavy with clouds. Off to the right, in front of the high school and under a long red canopy, was a large bulletin board where people stuck messages and questions. The board was always jammed, and Sister had walked along it the day before, looking at the pleas scribbled on scratch paper. Searching for daughter, Becky Rollins, age 14, lost in Shenandoah area, July 17th. Anybody with information about the DiBattista family from Scranton, please leave. Looking for Reverend Bowden, First Presbyterian Church of Hazleton, services urgently needed. Sister walked to the fence that surrounded the football field, set the duffel bag on the ground beside her, and wound her fingers tightly through the mesh. Behind her came the sound of a woman wailing at the bulletin board, and Sister flinched. Oh, God, Sister thought, what have we done?
Kansas, huh? What the hell do you want to go way out there for?
Paul Thorson was beside her, leaning against the fence. There was a splint along the bridge of his broken nose.
Kansas, he prompted. What's out there?
A town called Matheson. I saw it in the glass ring and I found it in the road atlas. That's where I'm going.
Yeah, but why?
He pulled up the collar of his battered leather jacket against the cold. He'd fought to keep the jacket as hard as Sister had fought for her duffel bag, and he wore it over the clean white coveralls.
Because...
She paused, and then she decided to tell him what she'd been thinking since she'd found the road atlas.
Because I feel like I'm being led towards something or someone. I think the things I've been seeing in that glass are real. My dream walking has been to real places. I don't know why or how. Maybe the glass ring is like, I don't know, like an antenna or something, or like radar, or a key to a door I've never even knew existed. I think I'm being led for some reason, and I've got to go.
Now you're talking like a lady who saw a monster with roaming eyeballs. I don't expect you to understand. I don't expect you to give a shit. And I didn't ask you. What are you doing hanging around me anyway? Didn't they assign you a tent?
Yeah, they did. I'm in with three other men. One of them cries all the time, and another one can't stop talking about baseball. I hate baseball.
What don't you hate, Mr. Thorson?
He shrugged and looked around, watching an elderly man and woman, both of their faces streaked with keloids, supporting each other as they staggered away from the bulletin board.
I don't hate being alone, he said finally. I don't hate depending on myself, and I don't hate myself, though sometimes I don't like myself too much. I don't hate drinking. That's about it.
Good for you. Well, I want to thank you for saving my life, and Artie's too. You took good care of us, and I appreciate that.
So?
She stuck out her hand, but he didn't shake it.
What have you got that's worth a damn?
He asked her.
Huh?
Something valuable. Do you have anything worth trading?
Trading for what?
He nodded toward the vehicles parked on the field. He saw he was looking at a dented old army jeep with a patched convertible top painted with camouflage colors.
You got anything in that bag you could trade for a jeep?
No, I don't.
And then she remembered that deep down in her duffel bag were the chunks of jewel-encrusted glass she'd picked up, along with the ring in the ruins of Steuben Glass and Tiffany's. She transferred them from the Gucci bag and forgotten them.
You're going to need transportation, he said. You can't walk from here to Kansas. And what are you going to do about gasoline, food, and water? You'll need a gun, matches, a good flashlight, and warm clothes. Like I say, lady, what's out there is going to be like Dodge City and Dante's Inferno rolled into one.
Maybe it will be, but why should you care?
I don't. I'm just trying to warn you, that's all.
I can take care of myself.
Yeah, I'll bet you can. I'll bet you were the bitch of the ball.
Hey, somebody called. Hey, I've been looking for you, lady.
Approaching them was the tall man in the fleece-lined coat and Stroh's beer cap who had been on sentry duty and heard the gunshots.
Been looking for you,
he said as he chewed a couple of sticks of gum.
Eichelbaum said you were around. You found me. What is it?
Well, he said, I kind of thought you was familiar the first time I seen you. He said you'd be carrying a big leather bag, though, so I guess that's what threw me.
What are you talking about?
It was 2-3 days before you folks got here. Fella just come riding along I-80 like he was out on a Sunday afternoon. He was on one of them French racing bicycles with the handlebars slung low. Oh, I remember him, because old Bobby Coates and me was up in the church tower on lookout, and Bobby punches me in the arm and says, Cleve,
look at that shit.
Well, I looked, and I seen it. But I still didn't believe it. Speak English, friend, Paul snapped. What was it?
Oh, it was a man pedaling that bike along I-80. But what was real weird was that he about had 30 or 40 wolves following him, almost at his heels, just parading along. And just before he gets to the top of the hill, this fella gets off his bike and turns around. And them wolves cower and slink like they was face to face with God. Then they broke and ran. And this fella walks his bike to the top of the hill. Cleve shrugged, puzzlement scrawled across his bovine face.
Well, we went out to get him, big fella, husky. Hard to tell how old he was, though. He had white hair, but his face was young. Anyway, he was wearing a suit and tie and a gray raincoat. Didn't seem to be hurt or anything. He had on two-toned shoes. I remember that real well. Two-toned shoes.
Cleve grunted, shook his head, and directed his gaze at Sister.
He asked about you, lady. Asked if we'd seen a lady with a big leather bag. Said you was a relative and that he had to find you. He seemed real eager and interested to find you, too. But me and Bobby didn't know nothing about you, of course, and this fella asked the other sentries, but they didn't know you either.
Said we'd take him into Homewood, give him a meal and shelter, and let the Red Cross folks look him over. Sister's heart had begun pounding, and she felt very cold. What happened to him? Oh, he went on. Thanked us kindly and said he had miles to go yet. Then he wished us well and pedaled on out of sight, heading west.
How'd you know this guy was looking for her? Paul asked. He could have been searching for some other woman carrying a leather bag.
Oh, no, Cleve answered and smiled. He described this lady here so well, I could see her face right in my head, just like a picture. That's why I thought you looked familiar at first, but I just this morning put it together. See, you didn't have a leather bag, and that's what threw me. He looked at Sister. Did you know him, ma'am?
Yes, she replied. Oh, yes, I know him. Did he give you his name?
Hallmark, Daryl, Dal, Dave, something like that. Well, he's gone west. Don't know what he'll find out there. Too bad you two missed each other so near.
Yes,
Sister felt as if her ribs had been laced with steel bands.
Too bad.
Cleve tipped his hat and went on about his business. Sister felt as if she were about to faint, and she had to lean against the fence for support.
Who was he?
Paul asked, but the tone of his voice said that he was afraid to know.
I've got to go to Kansas, Sister said firmly. I've got to follow what I've seen in the glass ring. He's not going to give up looking for me because he wants the glass ring too. He wants to destroy it, and I can't let him get his hands on it, or I'll never know what I'm supposed to find or who I'm looking for.
You're going to need a gun.
Paul was spooked by both Cleve's story and the terror in Sister's eyes. Nobody human could have gotten through those wolves without a scratch, he thought, and on a French racing bicycle? Was it possible that everything she told him was true?
A real big gun, he added.
There's not one big enough.
She picked up her duffel bag and started walking away from the high school, up the hill toward the tent she'd been assigned to. Paul stood watching her go.
Shit, he thought. What's going on here?
That lady's got a ton of guts, but she's going to get herself slaughtered out there on old I-80. He thought she had about as much chance to get to Kansas alone as a Christian in a Cadillac had of getting to heaven. He looked around at the hundreds of tents in the wooded hills, at the little campfires and burning lanterns that surrounded Homewood, and he shuddered. This damned town's got too many people in it, he thought. He couldn't stand having to live in a tent with three other men. Everywhere he turned, there were people. They were all over the place, and he knew that pretty soon he'd have to hit the road or go crazy. So, why not go to Kansas? Why not? Because, he answered himself, we'll never get there. So, were you planning on living forever? I can't let her go alone, he decided. Jesus Christ, I just can't.
Hey,
he called after her, but she kept going, didn't even look back.
Hey, maybe I'll help you get a Jeep, but that's all. Don't expect me to do anything else.
Sister kept walking, burdened with thought.
Okay, I'll help you get some food and water, too,
Paul told her.
But you're on your own with a gun and gasoline.
One step at a time, she was thinking. One step at a time gets you where you're going. And, oh, Lord, I've got such a long way to go.
Okay, damn it. I'll help you.
Sister finally heard him. She turned toward Paul.
What'd you say?
I said I'd help you.
He shrugged and started walking toward her.
I might as well add another layer to the shit cake, huh?
Yes,
she said, and a smile played at the corners of her mouth.
You might as well.
Darkness came, and an icy rain fell on Homewood. In the woods, the wolves howled, and the wind blew radiation across the land, and the world turned toward a new day.
Chapter 47. The bicycle's tires made a singing sound in the dark. Every so often they thumped over a corpse or veered around a wrecked car, but the legs that powered them had places to go. Two-toned shoes on the pedals, the man leaned forward and pumped along Interstate 80, about 12 miles east of the Ohio line. The ashes of Pittsburgh flecked his suit. He'd spent 2 days amid the ruins, had found a group of survivors there, and looked into their minds for the face of the woman with the circle of glass. But it wasn't in any of their heads, and before he'd left, he'd convinced them all that eating the burned meat of dead bodies was a cure for radiation poisoning. He'd even help them start on the first one. Bon appetit, he thought. Below him, his legs pumped like pistons. Where are you? He wondered. You can't have come this far, not yet. Unless you're running day and night because you know I'm on your ass. When the wolves had come out to first snap and then fawn at his heels, he'd thought they had gotten her, way back in eastern Pennsylvania. But if that were so, where was the leather bag? Her face hadn't been in the minds of the sentries back at Homewood, either. And if she'd been there, they would be the ones to know. So where was she? And, most importantly, where was the glass thing? He didn't like the idea of its being out there somewhere, didn't know what it was or why it had come to be, but whatever it was, he wanted to smash it beneath his shoes, wanted to break it into tiny fragments and grind those pieces into the woman's face. Sister, he thought, and he sneered. His fingers clenched the handlebars. The glass circle had to be found, had to be. This was his party now, and such things were not allowed. He didn't like the way the woman had looked at it, and he didn't like the way she'd fought for it, either. It gave her false hope. So it was a humane thing, really, to find the glass circle and smash it and make her eat the shards. There was no telling how many others she could infect if she wasn't stopped. Maybe she was already dead. Maybe one of her own kind had killed her and stolen the bag. Maybe, maybe, maybe. There were too many maybes. But no matter who had it or where it was, he had to find the glass circle, because such a thing as that should not be. And when it had gone dark and cold in his grip, he'd known it was reading his soul. "This is my party!" he shouted, and he drove over a dead man lying in his path. But there were so many places to search, so many highways to follow. She must have turned off I-80 before she'd reached Homewood, but why would she? He remembered her saying, "We keep going west," and she would follow the line of least resistance, wouldn't she? Could she have taken shelter in one of the small hamlets between Jersey City and Homewood? If so, that would mean she was behind him, not ahead. But everything and everyone was dead east of Homewood and that damned Red Cross station, right? He slowed down, passing a crumpled sign that said, "Newcastle, next left." He was going to have to pull off and find a map somewhere, maybe retrace his route along another highway. Maybe she'd gone south and missed Homewood entirely. Maybe she was on a rural road somewhere right now, crouched by a fire and playing with that damned glass thing. Maybe, maybe, maybe. It was a big country. But he had time, he reasoned, as he swung off I-80 at the Newcastle exit. He had tomorrow, and the next day, and the day after that. It was his party now, and he made the rules. He'd find her. Oh, yes. Find her and shove that glass ring right up her. He realized the wind had died down. It wasn't blowing as hard as it had been even a few hours before. That was why he hadn't been able to search properly yet. He had trouble searching when the wind was so rough, but the wind was his friend too, because it spread the party dust. He licked a finger with a cat-rough tongue and held it up. Yes, the wind had definitely weakened, though
Errant gusts still blew in his face and brought the smell of burned meat. It was time, past time, to get started. His mouth opened, stretched, and began to stretch wider still, while his black eyes stared from a handsome face. A fly crawled out onto his lower lip. It was a shiny, ugly green, the kind of fly that might explode from the nostrils of a bloated corpse. It waited there, its iridescent wings twitching. Another fly crawled from his mouth. Then a third, a fourth, and a fifth. Six more scrabbled out and clung to his lower lip. A dozen others seeped out like a green tide. In another few seconds, there were 50 or more flies around his mouth, a green froth that hummed and twitched with eager anticipation. "Away," he whispered, and the movement of his lips sent the first group of them into the air, their wings vibrating against the wind until they found their balance. Others took off, 9 or 10 at a time, and their formations flew to all points of the compass. They were part of him, and they lived down in the damp cellar of his soul where such things grew. And after they made their slow radius of 2 or 3 miles, they'd return to him as if he were the center of the universe. And when they came back, he'd see what they'd seen. A fire burning, sparking off a ring of glass, or her face asleep in a room where she thought she was safe. If they didn't find her tonight, there was always tomorrow and the next day. Sooner or later, they would find a chink in a wall that brought him down on her, and this time he'd walk Tusi on her bones. His face was rigid, his eyes black holes in a face that would scare the moon. The last two things that resembled flies but were extensions of his ears and eyes pushed from between his lips and lifted off, turning toward the southeast. And still, his two-toned shoes pumped the pedals, and the bike's tires sang, and the dead were ground under where they lay. Book 2 Part 8 Toad Frog with Golden Wings. The last apple tree. Flee the mark of Cain. The good deed done. Job's mask. Solitary journeyer. A new right hand. White blossoms. Chapter 48 Snow tumbled from the sullen sky, sweeping across a narrow country road in what had been 7 years before, the state of Missouri. A piebald horse, old and sway-backed, but still strong-hearted and willing to work, pulled a small, crudely built wagon covered with a patched dark green canvas dome that was a strange amalgam of Conestoga and U-Haul trailer. The wagon's frame was made of wood, but it had iron axles and rubber tires. The canvas dome was a 2-man all-weather tent that had been stretched over curved wooden ribs. On each side of the canvas, painted in white, was the legend, Travelin' Show, and beneath that, smaller letters proclaimed, Magic, Music, and Beat the Masked Mephisto. A couple of thick boards served as a seat and footrest for the wagon's driver, who sat draped in a heavy woolen coat that was beginning to come apart at the seams. He wore a cowboy hat, its brim heavy with ice and snow, and on his feet were battered old cowboy boots. The gloves on his hands were essential to ward off the stinging wind, and a woolen scarf was wrapped around the lower part of his face. Just his eyes, a shade between hazel and topaz, and a slice of rough, wrinkled skin were exposed to the elements. The wagon moved slowly across a snow-covered landscape, past black, dense forests stripped bare of leaves. On each side of the road, an occasional barn or farmhouse had collapsed under the weight of 7 years of winter, and the only signs of life were black crows that pecked fitfully at the frozen earth. A few yards behind the wagon,
A large figure in a long, billowing gray overcoat trudged along, booted feet crunching on snow. He kept his hands thrust into the pockets of his brown corduroy trousers, and his entire head was covered with a black ski mask, the eyes and mouth ringed with red. His shoulders were bent under the whiplash of wind, and his legs ached with the cold. About 10 feet behind him, a terrier followed, its coat white with snow. "I smell smoke," Rusty Weathers thought, and he narrowed his eyes to peer through the white curtain before him. Then the wind shifted direction, gnawing at him from another angle, and the smell of wood smoke, if it had really been there at all, was gone. But in another few minutes, he thought they must be getting near civilization. On the right, scrawled in red paint on the broad trunk of a leafless oak tree, was "Burn Your Dead." Signs like that were commonplace, usually announcing that they were coming into a settled area. There could be either a village ahead or a ghost town full of skeletons, depending on what the radiation had done. The wind shifted again, and Rusty caught that aroma of smoke. They were going up a gentle grade, Mule laboring as best he could, but in no hurry. Rusty didn't push him. What was the use? If they could find shelter for the night, fine. If not, they'd make do somehow. Over the course of 7 long years, they had learned how to improvise and use what they could find to the best advantage. The choice was simple. It was either survive or die, and many times Rusty Weathers had felt like giving up and lying down. But either Josh or Swan had kept him going with jokes or taunts, just as he had kept both of them alive over the years. They were a team that included Mule and Killer as well, and on the coldest nights when they'd had to sleep with minimal shelter, the warmth of the two animals had kept Rusty, Josh, and Swan from freezing to death. After all, Rusty thought with a faint, grim smile beneath the plaid scarf, the show must go on. As they reached the top of the grade and started down on the winding road, Rusty caught a yellow glint through the falling snow off to the right. The light was obscured by dead trees for a minute, but then there it was, and Rusty felt sure it was the glint of a lantern or a fire. He knew calling to Josh was useless, both because of the wind and because Josh's hearing wasn't too good. He reined Mule in and pressed down with his boot, a wooden lever that locked the front axle. Then he climbed down off the seat and went back to show Josh the light and tell him he was going to follow it. Josh nodded. Only one eye showed through the black ski mask. The other was obscured by a gray, scab-like growth of flesh. Rusty climbed back onto the wagon seat, released the brake, and gave a gentle flick to the reins. Mule started off without hesitation, and Rusty figured he'd smelled the smoke and knew shelter might be near. Another road, narrower yet and unpaved, curved to the right over snow-covered fields. The glint of light got stronger, and soon Rusty could make out a farmhouse ahead, light glowing through a window. Other outbuildings were set off beside the house, including a small barn. Rusty noted that the woods had been cut away from around the house in all directions, and hundreds of stumps stuck up through the snow. There was just one dead tree remaining, small and skinny, standing about 30 yards in front of the house. He smelled the aroma of burning wood and figured that the forest was being consumed in somebody's fireplace. But burning wood didn't smell the same as it had before the 17th of July and radiation had seeped into the forests. The smoke had a chemical odor, like burning plastic. Rusty remembered the sweet aroma of clean logs in a fireplace, and he figured that particular scent was lost forever, just like the taste of clean water. Now all the water tasted skunky and left a film on the inside of the mouth. Drinking water from melted snow, which was about all the remaining supply, brought on headaches, stomach pains, and blurred vision if consumed in too large a dose. Fresh water, like from a well or a bottled supply, was as valuable now as any fine French wine in the world that used to be.
Rusty pulled Mule up in front of the house and braked the wagon. His heart was beating harder. Here comes the tricky part, he thought. Plenty of times they'd been fired on when they stopped to ask for shelter, and Rusty carried the scar of a bullet crease across his left cheek. There was no movement from the house. Rusty reached back and partially unzipped the tent's flap. Within, distributed around the wagon so as to keep its weight balanced, was their meager total of supplies. A few plastic jugs of water, some cans of beans, a bag of charcoal briquettes, extra clothes and blankets, their sleeping bags, and the old Martin acoustic guitar Rusty was teaching himself to play. Music always drew people, gave them something to break the monotony. In one town, a grateful woman had given them a chicken when Rusty had painstakingly picked out the chords of Moon River for her. He'd found the guitar in a pile of songbooks in the dead town of Sterling, Colorado.
"Where are we?"
the girl asked from the tent's interior. She'd been curled up in her sleeping bag, listening to the restless whine of the wind. Her speech was garbled, but when she spoke slowly and carefully, Rusty could understand it.
"We're at a house. Maybe we can use the barn for the night."
He glanced over to the red blanket that was wrapped around three rifles. A .38 pistol and boxes of bullets lay in a shoebox within easy reach of his right hand.
"Like my old mama always told me," he thought, "you've got to fight fire with fire."
He wanted to be ready for trouble, and he started to pick up the .38 to hide under his coat when he approached the door. Swan interrupted his thoughts by saying,
"You're more likely to get shot if you take the gun."
He hesitated, recalling that he'd been carrying a rifle when that bullet had streaked across his cheek.
"Yeah, I reckon so," he agreed. "Wish me luck."
He zipped the flap again and got down off the wagon, took a deep breath of wintry air, and approached the house. Josh stood by the wagon watching, and Killer relieved himself next to a stump. Rusty started to knock on the door, but as he raised his fist, a slit opened in the door's center and the barrel of a rifle slid smoothly out to stare him in the face. "Oh, shit," he thought. But his legs had locked, and he stood helplessly.
"Who are you, and what do you want?"
a man's voice asked. Rusty lifted his hands.
"Name's Rusty Weathers. Me and my two friends out there need a place to shelter before it gets too dark. I saw your light from the road, and I see you've got a barn, so I was wondering if..."
"Where'd you come from?"
"West of here. We passed through Howe's Mill and Bixby. Ain't nothing left of them towns."
"I know.
Please, mister, all we want is a place to sleep. We've got a horse that sure could use a roof over his head."
"Take off that kerchief and let me see your face. Who you trying to look like, Jesse James?"
Rusty did as the man told him. There was silence for a moment.
"It's awful cold out here, mister," Rusty said.
The silence stretched longer. Rusty could hear the man talking to someone else, but he couldn't make out what was being said. Then the rifle barrel was suddenly withdrawn into the house, and Rusty let his breath out in a white plume. The door was unbolted. Several bolts were thrown back, and then it opened. A gaunt, hard-looking man, about 60 or so, with curly white hair and the untrimmed white beard of a hermit, stood before him, the rifle held at his side but still ready. The man's face was so tough and wrinkled it resembled carved stone, and his dark brown eyes moved from Rusty to the wagon.
"What's that say on the side there? Traveling show? What in the name of Judas is that?"
"Just what it says. We're entertainers."
An elderly white-haired woman in blue slacks and a heavy white sweater peered warily over the man's shoulder.
"Entertainers," the man repeated, and he frowned as if he'd smelled something bad.
His gaze came back to Rusty.
"You entertainers got any food?"
"We've got some canned food, beans and stuff.
We've got a pot of coffee and a little bit of salt pork. Put your wagon in the barn and bring your beans."
Then he closed the door in Rusty's face.
When Rusty had driven the wagon into the barn, he and Josh untied mule's traces so the horse could get to a small pile of straw and some dried corn cobs. Josh poured water into a pail for mule and found a discarded mason jar for Killer to drink water from. The barn was well constructed and kept the wind out, so neither animal would be in danger of freezing when the light went out and the real cold descended.
"What do you think?" Josh asked Rusty quietly. "Can she go in?"
"I don't know. They seem okay, but a mite jittery.
She can use the heat, if they've got a fire going."
Josh blew into his hands and bent over to massage his aching knees.
"We can make them understand it's not contagious."
"We don't know it's not."
"You haven't caught it, have you? If it was contagious, you'd have caught it long before now, don't you think?"
Rusty nodded. "Yeah, but how are we going to make them believe that?" The rear flap of the wagon's canvas dome was suddenly unzipped from the inside. Swan's mangled voice said from within, "I'll stay here. There's no need for me to scare anybody."
"They've got a fire in there," Josh told her, walking toward the rear of the wagon.
Swan was standing up, crouched over and silhouetted by the dim lamplight.
"I think it's all right if you go in."
"No, it's not. You can bring my food to me out here. It's better that way."
Josh looked up at her. She had a blanket around her shoulders and shrouding her head. In 7 years, she had shot up to about 5'9", gangly and long-limbed. It broke his heart that he knew she was right. If the people in that house were jittery, it was for the best that she stay here.
"Okay," he said in a strangled voice. "I'll bring you out some food."
Then he turned away from the wagon before he had to scream.
"Pass me down a few cans of those beans, will you?"
Rusty asked her. She picked up Crybaby and tapped the cans with it, then moved over to pick up a couple. She put them into Rusty's hands.
"Rusty, if they can spare some books, I sure would be grateful," she said. "Anything will do."
He nodded, amazed that she could still read.
"We won't be long," Josh promised, and he followed Rusty out of the barn.
When they had gone, Swan lowered the wooden tailgate and put a little stepladder down to the ground. Probing with the dowsing rod, she descended the ladder and walked to the barn door, her head and face still shrouded by the blanket. Killer walked along at her booted feet, tail wagging furiously, and barked for attention. His bark wasn't as sprightly as it had been 7 years earlier, and age had taken the bounce out of the terrier's step. Swan paused, laid Crybaby aside, and picked Killer up. Then she cracked the barn door open and cocked her head way over to the left, peering out through the falling snow. The farmhouse looked so warm, so inviting, but she knew it was best that she stay where she was. In the silence, her breathing sounded like an asthmatic rasp. Through the snow, she could make out that single remaining tree by the spill of light from the front window. Why just one tree, she wondered. Why did he cut the rest of them down and leave that one standing alone? Killer strained up and licked into the darkness where her face was. She stood looking at that single tree for a minute longer, and then she closed the barn door, picked up Crybaby, and probed her way over to Mule to rub his shoulders. In the farmhouse, a fire blazed in a stone hearth. Over the flames, a cast-iron pot of salt pork was bubbling in a vegetable broth. Both the stern-faced elderly man and his more timid wife flinched noticeably when Josh Hutchins followed Rusty through the front door. It was his size more than the mask that startled them, for though he'd lost a lot of flabby weight in the last few years, he'd gained muscle and still was a formidable sight. Josh's hands were streaked with white pigment, and the elderly man stared uncomfortably at them until Josh stuck them in his pockets. "Here are the beans," Rusty said nervously, offering them to the man.
He'd noted that the rifle leaned against the hearth, well within reach if the old man decided to go for it. The cans of beans were accepted, and the old gent gave them to the woman. She glanced nervously at Josh and then went back to the rear of the house. Rusty peeled off his gloves and coat, laid them over a chair, and took his hat off. His hair had turned almost completely gray, and there were streaks of white at his temples, though he was only 40 years old. His beard was ribboned with gray, the bullet scar a pale slash across his cheek. Around his eyes were webs of deep cracks and wrinkles. He stood in front of the hearth, basking in its wonderful warmth.
"Good fire you got here," he said. "Sure takes the chill off."
The old man was still staring at Josh.
"You can take that coat and mask off if you like."
Josh shrugged out of his coat. Underneath he wore two thick sweaters, one on top of the other. He made no move to take off the black ski mask. The old man walked closer to Josh, then abruptly stopped when he saw the gray growth obscuring the giant's right eye.
"Josh is a wrestler," Rusty said quickly. "The masked Mephisto. That's him. I'm a magician. See, we're a traveling show. We go from town to town and we perform for whatever people can spare to give us. Josh wrestles anybody who wants to take him on, and if the other fella gets Josh off his feet, the whole town gets a free show."
The old man nodded absently, his gaze riveted on Josh. The woman came back in with the cans she'd opened and dumped their contents into the pot, then stirred the concoction with a wooden spoon. Finally, the old gent said,
"Looks like somebody beat the ever-loving shit out of you, mister. Guess that town got a free show, huh?"
He grunted and gave a high, cackling laugh. Rusty's nerves untensed somewhat. He didn't think there would be any gunplay today.
Fetch us a cup of coffee," the old man said, and he left the room.
Josh went over to warm himself at the fire, and the woman scurried away from him as if he carried the plague. Not wanting to frighten her, he crossed the room and stood at the window, looking out at the sea of stumps and the single-standing tree.
"Name's Sylvester Moody," the old man said when he returned with a tray bearing some brown clay mugs. "Folks used to call me Sly, after that fellow who made all them fighting movies."
He set the tray down on a little pinewood table, then went to the mantel and picked up a thick asbestos glove. He put it on and reached into the fireplace, unhooking a scorched metal coffee pot from a nail driven into the rear wall.
"Good and hot," he said, and he started to pour the black liquid into the cups. "Don't have no milk or sugar, so don't ask."
He nodded toward the woman.
"This is my wife, Carla. She's kind of nervous around strangers."
Rusty took one of the hot cups and downed the coffee with pure pleasure, though the liquid was so strong it could have whipped Josh in a wrestling match.
"Why one tree, Mr. Moody?" Josh asked.
"Huh?"
Josh was still standing at the window.
"Why'd you leave that one? Why not cut it down with the others?"
Sly Moody picked up a cup of coffee and took it over to the masked giant. He tried very hard not to stare at the white splotched hand that accepted the cup.
"I've lived in this house for near about 35 years, he answered. "That's a long time to live in one house on one piece of land, ain't it? Oh, I used to have a fine cornfield that way."
He motioned toward the rear of the house.
"Used to grow a little tobacco and some pole beans, and every year me and Jeanette would go out into the garden and..."
He trailed off, blinked, and glanced over at Carla, who was looking at him with wide, shocked eyes.
I'm sorry, darling," he said. "I mean, me and Carla would go out in the garden and bring back baskets of good vegetables."
The woman, seemingly satisfied, stopped stirring the pot and left the room.
"Jeanette was my first wife," Sly explained in a hushed voice. "She passed on about 2 months after it happened. Then one day I was walking up the road to Ray Featherstone's place, about a mile from here, I guess, and I came across a car that had gone off the road and was half buried in a snowdrift. Well, there was a dead man with a blue face at the wheel, and next to him was a woman who was near about dead. There was a gutted carcass of a French poodle in her lap, and she had a nail file gripped in her hand, and I don't want to tell you what she did to keep herself from freezing. Anyway, she was so crazy she didn't know anything, not even her own name or where she was from. I called her Carla after the first girl I ever kissed. She just stayed, and now she thinks she's been living on this farm with me for 35 years. He shook his head, his eyes dark and haunted. Funny thing, too. That car was a Lincoln Continental, and when I found her, she was decked out in diamonds and pearls. I put all that junk away in a shoebox and traded it for sacks of flour and bacon. I figured she didn't need to ever see him again. People came along and salvaged parts off the car, and by, there was nothing left. Better that way. Carla returned with some bowls and began to spoon the stew into them. "Bad days," Sly Moody said softly, staring at the tree. Then his eyes began to clear, and he smiled faintly. "That there's my apple tree." "Yes, sir. See, I used to have an apple orchard clear across that field. Used to bring in apple by the bushel. But after it happened and the trees died, I started cutting them down for firewood. You don't want to go too far into the forest for firewood, uh-uh. Ray Featherstone froze to death about 100 yards from his own front door." He paused for a moment and then sighed heavily. "I planted them apple trees with my own hands. Watched them grow, watched them burst with fruit. You know what today is?" "No," Josh said. "I keep a calendar. One mark for every day. Worn out a lot of pencils, too. Today is the 26th day of April. Springtime." He smiled bitterly. "I've cut them all down, but the one, and thrown them in the fire piece by piece. But damned if I can put an axe to that last one. Damned if I can."
"The food's almost ready," Carla announced. She had a northern accent, decidedly different from Sly's languid Missouri drawl. "Come and get it."
"Hold on," Sly looked at Rusty. "I thought you said you were with two friends."
"I did. There's a girl traveling with us. She's..." He glanced quickly at Josh, then back to Sly. "She's out in the barn."
"A girl? Well, Christ almighty, fella, bring her in here and let her get some hot food."
I don't think..."
"Go on and get her," he insisted. "Barn ain't no place for a girl."
"Rusty." Josh was peering out the window. Night was fast descending, but he could still see the last apple tree and the figure that stood beneath it.
"Come here for a minute."
Outside, Swan held the blanket around her head and shoulders like a cape and looked up at the branches of the spindly apple tree. Killer ran a couple of rings around the tree and then barked half-heartedly, wanting to get back to the barn. Above Swan's head, the branches moved like skinny, searching arms. She walked forward, her boots sinking through 5 inches of snow, and placed her bare hand against the tree's trunk. It was cold beneath her fingers, cold and long dead. Just like everything else, she thought, all the trees, the grass, the flowers, everything scorched lifeless by radiation many years ago. But it was a pretty tree, she decided. It was dignified, like a monument. And it didn't deserve to be surrounded by the ugly stumps of what had been. She knew that the hurting sound in this place must have been a long wail of agony. Her hand moved lightly across the wood. Even in death, there was something proud about the tree, something defiant and elemental, a wild spirit, like the heart of a flame that could never be totally extinguished. Killer yapped at her feet, urging her to hurry whatever she was doing. Swan said, "All right, I'm re—" She stopped speaking. The wind whirled around her, tugging at her clothes. Could it be? She wondered. I'm not dreaming this, am I? Her fingers were tingling, just barely enough to register through the cold. She placed her palm against the wood. A prickling pins-and-needles sensation coursed through her hand, still faint, but growing, getting stronger. Her heart leaped. Life, she realized. There was life there yet, deep in the tree. It had been so long, so very long, since she'd felt the stirring of life beneath her fingers. The feeling was almost new to her again, and she realized how much she'd missed it. Now, what felt like a mild electric current seemed to be rising up from the earth through the soles of her boots, moving up her backbone, along her arm, and out her hand into the wood. When she drew her hand away, the tingling ceased. She pressed her fingers to the tree again, her heart pounding, and there was a shock so powerful it felt as if fire had shot up her spine. Her body trembled. The sensation was steadily getting stronger, almost painful now, her bones aching with the pulse of energy passing through her and into the tree. When she could stand it no longer, she pulled her hand back. Her fingers continued to prickle, but she wasn't finished yet. On an impulse, she extended her index finger and traced letters across the tree trunk. S-W-A-N. Swan! The voice came from the house, startling her. She turned toward the sound, and as she did, the wind ripped at her makeshift cape and flung it back from her shoulders and head. Sly Moody was standing between Josh and Rusty, holding a lantern. By its yellow light, he saw that the figure under the apple tree had no face. Her head was covered by gray growths that had begun as small black warts, had thickened and spread over the passage of years, had connected with gray tendrils like groping, intertwining vines. The growths had covered her skull like a knotty helmet, had enclosed her facial features and sealed them up except for a small slit at her left eye and a ragged hole over her mouth through which she breathed and ate. Behind Sly, Carla screamed. Sly whispered, "Oh, my Jesus." The faceless figure grabbed the blanket and shrouded her head, and Josh heard her heartbreaking cry as she raced to the barn. Chapter 49. Darkness fell over the snow-covered buildings and houses of what had been Broken Bow, Nebraska. Barbed wire surrounded the town, and here and there bits of timber and rags burned in empty oil cans, the wind sending orange sparks spiraling into the sky. On the curving northwest arc of Highway 2, dozens of corpses lay frozen where they'd fallen, and the hulks of charred vehicles still spat flame. In the fortress that Broken Bow had been for the last 2 days, 317 sick and injured men, women, and children were trying desperately to keep warm around a huge central bonfire. The houses of Broken Bow were being torn apart and fed to the flames. Another 264 men and women, armed with rifles, pistols, axes, hammers, and knives, crouched in trenches, hastily hacked in the earth along the barbed wire at the western rim of town. Their faces were turned westward, into the shrilling sub-zero wind that had killed so many. They shivered in their ragged coats, and tonight they dreaded a different kind of death. "There!" A man with an ice-crusted bandage around his head shouted. He pointed into the distance. "There! They're coming!" A chorus of shouts and warnings moved along the trench. Rifles and pistols were quickly checked. The trench vibrated with nervous motion, and the breath of human beings whirled through the air like diamond dust. They saw the headlights weaving slowly through the carnage on the highway. Then the music drifted to them on the stinging wind. It was carnival music,
and as the headlights grew nearer, a skinny, hollow-eyed man in a heavy sheepskin coat stood up at the center of the trench and trained a pair of binoculars at the oncoming vehicle. His face was streaked with dark brown keloids. He put the binoculars down before the cold could seal the eye cups to his face.
"Hold your fire," he shouted to the left. "Pass it down."
The message began to go down the line. He looked to the right and shouted the same order, and then he waited, one gloved hand on the Ingram machine gun under his coat. The vehicle passed a burning car, and the red glare revealed it to be a truck with the remnants of paint on its sides, advertising different flavors of ice cream. Two loudspeakers were mounted atop the truck's cab, and the windshield had been replaced with a metal plate that had two narrow slits cut for the driver and passengers to see through. The front fender and radiator grille were shielded with metal, and from the armor protruded jagged metal spikes about 2 feet long. The glass of both headlights was reinforced with heavy tape and covered with wire mesh. On both sides of the truck were gun slits, and atop the truck was a crude sheet metal turret and the snout of a heavy machine gun. The armored Good Humor truck, its modified engine snorting, rolled with chain-covered tires over the carcass of a horse and stopped about 50 yards from the barbed wire. The merry, tape-recorded calliope music continued for perhaps another 2 minutes, and then there was silence. The silence stretched. A man's voice came through the loudspeakers.
"Franklin Hayes? Are you listening, Franklin Hayes?"
The skinny, weary man in the sheepskin coat narrowed his eyes, but said nothing.
"Franklin Hayes," the voice continued with a mocking, lilting note. "You've given us a good fight, Franklin Hayes. The Army of Excellence salutes you."
"Fuck you," a middle-aged, shivering woman said softly in the trench beside Hayes. She had a knife in her belt and a pistol in her hand, and a green keloid covered most of her face in the shape of a lily pad.
"You're a fine commander, Franklin Hayes. We didn't think you had the strength to get away from us at Dunning. We thought you'd die on the highway. How many of you are left, Franklin Hayes? 400? 500? And how many are able to keep fighting? Maybe half that number? The Army of Excellence has over 4,000 healthy soldiers, Franklin Hayes. Some of those used to suffer for you, but they decided to save their lives and cross over to our side."
Someone in the trench to the left fired a rifle, and several other shots followed. Hayes shouted,
"Don't waste your bullets, damn it!"
The firing dwindled, then ceased.
"Your soldiers are nervous, Franklin Hayes,"
the voice taunted.
"They know they're about to die."
"We're not soldiers," Hayes whispered to himself. "You crazy fucker, we're not soldiers." How his community of survivors, once numbering over 1,000 people trying to rebuild the town of Scott's Bluff, had gotten embroiled in this insane war, he didn't know. A van, driven by a husky, red-bearded man, had come into Scott's Bluff, and out had stepped another frail-figured man with bandages wrapping his face, all except his eyes, which were covered with goggles. The bandaged man had spoken in a high, young voice, had said that he'd been badly burned a long time ago. He'd asked for water and a place to spend the night, but he wouldn't let Dr. Gardner even touch his bandages. Hayes himself, as mayor of Scott's Bluff, had taken the young man on a walking tour of the structures they were rebuilding. Sometime during the night, the two men had driven away, and 3 days later, Scott's Bluff was attacked and burned to the ground. The screams of his wife and son still reverberated in Hayes's mind. Then Hayes had started leading the survivors east to escape the maniacs that pursued them, but the Army of Excellence had more trucks, cars, horses, trailers, and gasoline, more weapons and bullets and soldiers, and the group that followed Hayes had left hundreds of corpses in its wake.
This was an insane nightmare with no end, Hayes realized. Once he'd been an eminent professor of economics at the University of Wyoming, and now he felt like a trapped rat. The headlights of the armored Good Humor truck burned like two malevolent eyes.